Before we get started, I want to remind you that the DVD of my new documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste, is now available. Here's how you get it. Just go to the website, www.thecommentarytrack.com, click on the videos page, and there it is. You just click on that, and it'll take you to PayPal, and there you have it. Buy several, won't you? Thanks.
Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 49 of the Commentary Track. I'm your genial host, Frank Thompson. Got some special guests for you today. Out in the green room we have Mary Magoon and Wally Ballou and Webley Webster. I think Mary Magoon is going to say a song for us today, so that will be very nice. We also have another guest we'll talk to about film history, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. I hope that you will find your way over to iTunes to leave a nice review and a 5-star rating. You know, this sounds like that it's one of the most successful podcasts in the history of the earth. But the reality is that a pitifully few number of people have listened to this thing. And I want to try to raise that number to at least beyond double digits, if we possibly can. We've been podcasting for more than a year now, and I really hoped that we would be reaching more people by now. And the only thing I can do is to urge you to tell people about it, and to go on Facebook and Twitter and every other social media that you can think of, and tell people to come and sample the podcast. And it would also help a great deal if you'd go to iTunes and leave a nice review and a 5-star rating. Just in the last week or so, I've gotten a couple of really nice reviews. Here's one. I don't know who leaves them because they always, you know, come in under pseudonyms. Here's the most recent one. I love this podcast. Frank talks to loads of interesting people. Always lively discussion and something new to discover about the world of film. Listen and get hooked. Now that's a great review. I love that guy. Or a girl. Although I think it's got a Larry in it, so let's say guy. Another one. Best podcast I have found that feeds my old movie obsession. Don't stop. I'm trying not to stop, but I need more people to listen. Here's another good one. There's not another podcast like this one. By featuring intelligent conversation about films and film history from the most knowledgeable people around, it sets the bar high for any who wish to emulate. It also goes on to say that I'm as funny and knowledgeable as my guest, but I'm not going to read that part. Come on. What do you think I am, a braggart? No. Anyway, I wish that you would go in and do the same, say some nice things about it, but if you don't have the time to sit down and think of something nice to say, just click on the 5-star rating button, and that will help. And that'll help get more people over here, and we could listen and flourish and go on into the next millennium. It will not last that long. But the next solstice, I'll settle for that. So anyway, got a wonderful show for you today. If there is ever a Mount Rushmore of film historians, my guest today will be one of the faces upon it. David Shepherd is one of the real greats. I've known him for a long time. I wouldn't say known him well, but our paths have crossed many times, and it's always been pleasant when they have done so, and I've always gotten a kick out of talking with him, never more so than when we put down microphones up at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival a couple of months ago. We were in the manager's office of the Castro Theater, and you would think that would be a relatively quiet little chamber to do something like this, but no, it's not. That's a noisy second floor up there, and people are always congregating about outside, and so there might be a little bit of kerfuffle under our golden words, but just try to deal with that. And then we got kicked out a little earlier than we hoped that we would. I'm sorry I said that, because I can't even tell you why, but it's pretty funny. But anyway, We stopped a little bit abruptly, I would say, and that was a shame. But it's still a good, long, solid interview with one of the real greats in film preservation and film history, from his career at Black Hawk Films early on, and then at the AFI, and as a teacher at USC, and it's so many other things. And now he does film preservation on his own and has brought many, many great films to us, and we should all be grateful to David Shepherd. And I'm grateful to him for saying that he would sit down for this podcast, because he had better things to do. Believe me, that guy is a busy, busy guy. But I'm delighted that he did, and I think you'll be delighted with the conversation. So here's David Shepherd, and I'll see you on the other side. We're at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, at which, ironically enough, it's very hard to find a place quiet enough to record. Tell me first, let's be film festival-centric first, and tell me how many of the films that you worked on that are playing this weekend.
Well, there are two. Grabiche, which came from the Cinémathèque Française, and which I prepared for DVD with a new score by the Montalto Motion Picture Orchestra. It is included in our box set French Masterworks of five feature films from Albatross. And The House on Tribnaya Square, which is included in our Masters of Early Soviet Cinema box set, along with seven other films.
Mm. Now, I just watched that one moments ago, and it was delightful. It was not anything like you normally expect a Soviet film to be. Very funny, very witty, with a kind of deadpan wit.
I'm glad that you liked it. We try not to do boring films.
Well, good. I applaud that. I'm curious how these projects come to you. How many things do you choose that you want to work on, or how many are basically jobs of work that find you?
Nothing is really a job of work. I think the last job I did on assignment, and it was a quite wonderful assignment, was 20 years ago, the Chaplin feature films.
Ah.
But essentially, we work with films that are either in the public domain, which we can adapt and improve and issue, or films which we license and prepare in our own exclusive editions for publication. And if I'm not drawn to the film, I choose another film.
Okay. So, let's pursue that a little bit. Talk about Grabiche. How did that come into your life?
I was at the Pordenone Silent Film Festival. In over 2 years, they did a retrospective of Ivan Mozhikin and a retrospective of films from Albatross. And I was so taken with the films that I thought, gee, I would really like to do these. And as it happens, the Cinémathèque Française owns the rights to the entire library of Albatross films.
Hmm.
So it was, in making a deal with them, it was possible to get both the rights and the materials. And it took a long time. The French lawyers, like the mills of the gods, grind slowly, but very fine.
Yes.
And after about a year and a half of going back and forth, we were able to make a deal and get the films. There were five features that were all supposed to come with music, but only two of them did. So we arranged for the score with Rodney Sauer, which is exactly like the score that you just heard. And for Keane, Robert Israel did a score,
mm-hmm.
large orchestra score, 32-piece orchestra. And for the late Matthias Pascal, Timothy Brock had done a score for the Maginere Trovata in Bologna. And we were able to license that and pay Tim and use it. And we were supported in this, and as we have often been supported, by Turner Classic Movies.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Tabish at Turner seems to have a real love of independent film projects and of silent films. As you know, they run a silent film once a week at least. And I can go to him and say, I would like to do this, and I need so-and-so much money. And if he can manage it, he will.
Great.
And in this case, he did.
Now, for Grabiche, tell me a little bit about what you had to work with, because I noticed, obviously, as in many restorations, there's a certain variation in image quality, and did you have to work from multiple prints?
Actually, the Cinematheque Française provided the telecine, and it was from that same print that we saw, although the print was much fresher at the time the tape was made, and the telecine was extremely well done. I thought, actually, that the video transfer looked better than the projected film. It was cleaner. They had taken out splices, they had taken out cue marks, and I was very impressed with the quality of what they did. But we got it silent. We were responsible for the English subtitles. We adjusted the speed on some of the films in the set, and of course I just told you about the music. And we commissioned an essay from Lenny Borger, who lives in Paris, used to be the Paris correspondent for Variety, and makes a living doing English subtitles. But he is really expert on Albatross. He's published several articles, and he prepared the brochure, and we took the plunge.
Grabiche was, I thought, particularly notable for the tinting and toning, tinting and toning in the same scene.
Yes, an exceptionally beautiful print.
Yeah.
They had restored it twice. The first time they had an original negative of the export version, and they made a black and white fine grain, a black and white dupe. We had that also because it contains material that's not in the version that we just saw. But then when they discovered that it was the secondary negative, they went back to two original prints they had, put them together, sent them to Presstech in London, and Presstech made the color dupe and print, and gave us the version that you saw today. I love the film.
I do too. I really got a kick out of it, and it's one of those things, like The House on Drabaya Square, that I'd never even heard of before.
Well, I really wanted to see it because several years ago, we did a DVD set of three silent films by Jacques Feder, and two of them had that child in them.
Yes,
Jean Forest, Crankaby, and Faces of Children, Visage d'Enfants. And of course, I knew that he had done this third film, and really wanted to see it. And a friend of mine in France had seen it and said it was superb. So I was delighted when it turned up on the Portinoni schedule, and it was everything it had been advertised to be. So, I mean, we had the whole output of Albatross to choose among, because all but one or two of the films are extant. So I chose the five I liked the best.
The Russian film seemed to be in a little rougher shape, I'm assuming. Now, who did the transfer on that?
Well, we didn't use that print of the Russian film.
Oh, okay.
We used a much cleaner print.
So what we saw is not what's on the DVD?
No.
Yeah.
The copy that we saw today came from the Pacific Film Archive. The copy we used came from Harvard University, and it was just mint.
Oh, beautiful.
So it looks beautiful.
Good. I thought there might be a little missing footage in what we saw today. And I don't know if I was just napping, but I don't know what happened to the duck. I was very distressed about the duck.
Yeah, the duck sort of disappears, but there's a hint given when they throw a dead duck across the room onto the kitchen shopping block.
Yes, about what his fate may be.
Yes.
I seriously urge anyone who's interested in silent film to seek out both of these sets, because these individual films, at least, are wonderful. And really unlike, I mean, the Russian film is so unlike what you'd expect a Russian film of the time to
be. Not a single tractor in it.
No. but, yeah, really wonderful, almost like a Lubitsch quality, except a little bit more deadpan. The woman who played the lead has a wonderful stillness to her that I really loved. I want to go back a little bit and get some of your background. The earliest I know of your career was the Black Hawk period, but certainly something led to that. I don't think anybody grows up wanting to be in film preservation, do they? What did you originally set out to do?
Well, of course, I started as a teenage boy collecting film, as a young teen, because when I was about 12 years old, television was really taking hold. At that time, every town of any size that had a camera store also included in the store a 16mm rental library. People could rent film prints and projectors and show. I can remember my father doing that and showing them at my birthday parties. people would, you'd have friends over and you'd show a movie. When television came in, it wiped that out. And the camera stores then began to sell off their 16mm libraries. There was a camera store in Hackensack, New Jersey, which was within a bike ride of where I lived. Rieger's camera store. They had a very nice 16mm rental library, mostly silent films, and almost all nice original tinted Kodoscope prints and others of that vintage. I had a newspaper route, and I made $3.50 a week delivering the Bergen Evening Record. And Rieger's was intrigued by the idea that a little kid would be interested in these silent movies and would let me put down 50 cents on this one and 50 cents on that reel and so on as layaway. And each week I would go back and pay some off and put money down on some others so other people couldn't get them, you know. And that was the start of a kind of passionate film collecting hobby. Well, by 1968, the American Film Institute was starting, and one of their objectives was to build up the National Film Collection at the Library of Congress. And because I was known as a collector and had a lot of connections in the collector network of that time, they hired me to go out and acquire films for the library, which I did for 5 years, and it was pretty successful. Over the 5 years, we brought in about 8,000 films.
Were you acquiring them from private collectors?
Private collectors and making agreements with studios for whole libraries of negatives.
Wow.
After all, you could go to Warner Brothers and say, well, we would like to have these nitrate negatives of your productions of the 20s, 30s, 40s, and you can get a nice tax write-off for donating them, and you don't have to store all the nitrate film, but you continue to enjoy the rights that are guaranteed to you by copyright, and you can access the films when you want them.
Yeah.
It was a terrific deal.
Well, it sure was.
And
studios would have been insane to turn down something like that.
Well, they didn't turn it down.
Yeah.
We got the Warner Library, the Columbia Pictures Library, the RKO Library, and a lot of stuff from private collectors. And after I left, the library successfully secured the right to pick and choose a lot of films from Universal. And Paramount donated their file prints to UCLA Film Archive, which in many cases turned out to be the best surviving copies of those films, even though Universal had the negatives and had made fine grains in the 1950s, but not with particular care. So the archive movement of the 1970s, late 60s and 1970s, was really responsible for the salvation of far more American film than had been saved in all the preceding decades.
Wow.
Well, nobody at that time really knew how to work with shrunken film, deteriorated film, worn prints, and so on, and get good results. So the Library of Congress bought lab equipment, and by trial and error, we learned what to do. And there was a lot of trial at taxpayers' expense, a lot of error, but a lot of film got saved. It was from that I went to Black Hawk, because I knew that Black Hawk was sitting on a lot of one-of-a-kind original material. So I went to Davenport and talked with Kent Easton. He was very cooperative and gave us access to whatever we wanted. And eventually he offered me a job there as vice president of the company. Well, I thought that it was a wonderful thing to preserve the film at the Library of Congress, but I thought of the library as a sort of a roach motel. You know, the films went in, but they never came out.
Sure.
And Blackhawk's idea was to make inexpensive reproductions and sell them to anybody who wanted them, and sort of took the chains off the Bible. And I thought that was a very worthy thing.
Yeah, it's really amazing that nobody else was really doing it. I guess Museum of Modern Art was really the only other film library of any size at that point. I mean, not except outside the studios.
The Museum of Modern Art had a wonderful 16mm rental library. They were fairly restrictive in who could rent from them. I rented from them in college when I had a film society. You had to apply, you got a contract, you signed the contract went back, it had to be countersigned by a museum attorney, and if it was approved, you could then get the film. And it was wonderful to be able to show it, but of course, it was sort of like a yo-yo, you know, it was pulled back the next day. And the opportunity to actually own the film, show it to friends, study it, run it over and over, only really existed if you bought the prints. And Blackhawk was certainly the leader of that. At the time I went there, they had a mailing list of about 125,000 collectors who were buying mostly 8mm, and mostly comedies, but you know, still in all, in the days before video, that was an awful lot of film on very popular titles, like, say, Two Tars with Laurel and Hardy. We would sell 2,000 prints in a year.
Wow.
So it really was a chance to liberate material for popular viewing, and that very much appealed to me.
One thing that I remember, because when I first started collecting film in the 70s, of course, Blackhawk was the go-to place. And I was always a little nonplussed at the catalog by how many pages were given over to films about trains. Was that just something I don't get? I
mean, Kent Easton was a train fanatic. In fact, in the basement of his house, there was a whole wall lined with bound timetables from various rail lines over the decades. And he loved the train films, and they were his greatest pleasure. And he lived that way. I mean, he had a railroad conductor's watch, and we would go out to dinner quite often. And he would say, "Let's have dinner at the Davenport Club at 7:30. I'll pick you up at 7:23." and you know, that's how it worked.
Well, I figured there must have been also an avid audience for those things because they were always in the catalog.
You could reach a target audience. We did it through Trains magazine particularly. Now, it was a shallow market. Once we had a train film out for 3 or 4 months, most of the people who wanted to get it had gotten it.
Yeah.
And so we would take those out of the catalog and put in new train films. And there were railroad buffs all over the country.
Sure.
Who spent their weekend going and standing by the tracks filming run-bys. And, of course, trains were a really popular subject for both fiction and non-fiction film in the early years of the century.
Sure.
And we particularly looked for them.
Yeah. did you become interested in silent film primarily because that was what you could get from these shops in your teen years?
It actually predated that. I had an uncle who was a photographer in the Signal Corps during World War II. At the end of the war, he brought back and gave me as a gift a Pathé 9.5mm projector and a couple of boxes of film, which he had somehow got his hands on in Europe. And the films were four-reel cut-downs of big German films of the 20s, Faust, Metropolis, The White Hill of Pitsbaloo, and of French films, including Feder's Faces of Children, L'Argent of L'Herbier, and there were shorts, Méliès shorts, a lot of Hal Roach comedies, and, you know, I could show these at home and invite my friends. Many of the friends wouldn't come back very often, but...
that sounds like a treasure trove.
Yeah, and a little hand-crank Pathé projector that used an auto headlamp as a light source.
Wow.
And I could get a decent picture up to about maybe 3 feet wide. Of course, I had never seen films like that, but my parents had grown up with them, and they were enthusiastic about the silent films, and that's really what got me going and why I was interested in buying the stuff when I was in my teens. But, you know, it was sort of happenstance. You know, if I had ended up a baseball player, I suppose that I could go back to my childhood and trace the experiences that got me excited about baseball, of which there were none. But there were lots of experiences that got me excited about early films.
Yeah. It's interesting to me because a lot of us have a similar story. I mean, what we were exposed to at a certain age, and it became fun for us, and then we started looking into it more deeply. And as when I talked to Kevin on this podcast, Kevin Brownlow, I said, you know, none of us was alive during the silent era, so it's not nostalgia for any reason. It's just something that appealed to us for whatever reason that is.
Well, Kevin and I both had the pleasure of getting to know a lot of people who were prominent filmmakers in the silent era. And I admired them greatly. I mean, they were really, of course, talented people. They were entrepreneurial. They were pioneers. They knew how good they were, but they weren't arrogant. You know, they were happy that somebody was interested in their work. I mean, I used to have lunch with Henry King once a week.
Wow.
And there, a book finally came out of it. But he never ran...
I know.
Yeah, he never ran out... Oh, yes, you edited.
Yes.
He never ran out of stories. And the same was true with others. My wife at the time and I used to spend weekends in Paso Robles at King Vidor's house with him. And he would get fan mail from all over the world. You know, we'd take him into town because he got his mail at a post office box. He'd bring back this sheaf of letters and open it, and there would be letters from all over the world telling him how great he was. And then he would say, well, now that I've finished reading about how great I am, I'd better do the laundry.
now, when you... I mean, obviously, I know firsthand that you interviewed Henry King at length. Did you also do that with King Vidor and other people that you knew, or did you simply befriend them?
No, there's a book based on the oral history interviews that Nancy Dowd and I did with King Vidor. And I did a number of others, especially when I was at the Directors Guild, some of which were published and some of which have never been published, but these were all wonderful people. Another one that I thought was especially interesting, and it has never been published, was with Lucky Humberstone.
Yes.
Who was an assistant director on an amazing number of big films of the 1920s, which have turned out to be classics. And then he turned out to be a director of mostly shaky A's, but always with style, and within the limits of what he had to work with, he did good stuff. And he was a terrific person. Only the strange thing about Lucky was that it was sort of like Michigan J. Frog in that cartoon One Froggy Evening. You know, we'd be having lunch and he would just be regaling me with these wonderful stories. And then the recorder would go on and it would be ribbit. Because he didn't really want to talk about, for the record, people who weren't there to tell their own side.
That would hold him back from telling a lot of good stories, I would think.
Yeah, I heard them, but we didn't get them on tape.
Did you rush home and scribble them down while they were fresh in your mind?
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah. Did you ever have a particular style of film or particular director that you prized among above all others, or were you a small C Catholic in your views?
I did always and still think of films in terms of the director. You know, I think of the director as the person who tells the story, and in silent film, he tells the story by thinking in pictures. So other people are very interested in films according to the stars, and maybe some people are interested in films according to the studio or to the writer. But for me, it was always the director.
Yeah, me too.
And I'd be willing to look at anything by a director I admired or one I had never heard of to see what I thought. But the fact that, say, Constance Bennett was in it didn't matter to me one way or the other.
Yeah, I don't think I had that many stars that I would seek out simply because of the star, although obviously there are many stars that I love and I'm always glad to see, but when it comes to that, I was conscious of the director from much earlier than I should have been.
And the directors were so important in building these films. I mean, of course, we saw the Patsy the other night with Marion Davies, directed by King Vidor, who directed two other films with her, Show People and Not So Dumb, and then got written into his MGM contract that he no longer had to direct any films with Marion Davies or William Haynes.
Now, why was that? I would think that she would be delightful to work with, but was it the Hearst thing?
I think she was probably a great friend, but I didn't think he didn't want to get... I mean, he had made the big parade, he had made the crowd, you know. He was a person with ambition for the artistic potential of film, and I don't think he wanted to get stuck with light comedies, especially with W.R. Hearst looking over his shoulder. You know, other directors had different attitudes. Henry King, for example, used to liken himself to a physician. Well, a physician treats somebody who needs medical attention. He doesn't investigate the ethics of the person. He doesn't investigate their genealogy. He just tries to make them well. And he felt during his long, long tenure at Fox and 20th Century Fox that... all those people who depended on the studio for a living depended in a way on him making movies that people would go to see so that there would be enough revenue to keep everybody employed. And if he was assigned a picture, he did the best he could with it. And when he could get personal kinds of films, which Zanuck was sympathetic to from time to time, he would make those too. But he saw himself as a participant in an industrial exercise. And although he had a certain talent, he would do his best with whatever he was given.
Sure. I think that's a mistake, at least that I personally made when I first started out, is that the vision of the director seemed so strong to me that I've always assumed that the director had more power than maybe sometimes he did about choosing his own work. But there were a lot of people. I mean, obviously William Wellman is one of the top people to me, and there are some that are clearly his projects, and then there are five more after that that were just given to him, and he had to do it.
That's even true of John Ford.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, How Green Was My Valley, one of my favorite films.
Sure.
I mean, that film, as I'm sure you probably know, was intended for William Wyler.
Mm-hmm.
Wyler cast it. Wyler prepared it. Wyler worked on the sets. Wyler worked with Philip Dunn on the script. And then his time was up, and Goldwyn wouldn't renew his loan out. So they got John Ford, who shot it in something like 18 days.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's as Fordy in a film as you could find.
It certainly is. And it's just every frame of it screams John Ford. It's so interesting. Because you know that if Wyler had done it, the changes he made would have been probably fairly minimal. I mean, he had prepared it, so he just wouldn't have shot it exactly the same. But
well, Ford, he didn't know anything about Welsh miners, so he transformed these characters into shanty Irish.
Yes, and that worked fine.
It did indeed.
But, yeah, Ford is one of the guys that you, and Capra, are these directors that we always assume were in charge all the time. But Ford himself said, I do one for them and one for me. And maybe he did more than one for them and one for himself.
I mean, these people had enough power to draw the line. I mean, Ford did his one Shirley Temple.
Yeah.
But he wasn't going to do a lot of Shirley Temple.
He did a good Shirley Temple, though.
Oh, yes. Fine.
Well, and we alluded to it earlier, in case people don't know what we're talking about. You did a lot of interviewing of Henry King, and then the Directors Guild took all those interviews and those that were done by a man named Ted Perry,
mm-hmm.
who I never met. I don't know any more about him than that. And asked me to edit them into something like an autobiography, which was almost doable. It worked
very well. I remember reading a draft of it and sending it back with some fairly severe comments.
Sure.
But
I remember too, yeah.
Yeah. But in the final version, I think it very much reflects who Henry was, and he was someone I liked very much and admired. If there was one silent film that I saw as a boy that really made a huge impression on me, and still does whenever I show it to myself and friends, it's Tolerable David.
Oh, yeah. I agree. It's one of the greats. And Henry King is one of those people, and why I really treasured working on that project, although the pay was minuscule and this deadline was tight. But I did enjoy it because he's one of those people that I cannot really think of that many films that I don't like of his. I almost at least enjoy almost everything he ever did. And then there are several of his films that I just love and might not be the ones that everyone else thinks of. For instance, I'd Climb the Highest Mountain.
I love I'd Climb the Highest Mountain.
And Margie.
And Margie, Remember the Day is a beautiful film.
Love it.
But, you know, Chad Hanna, for example, for which I had great hopes because Henry, as a teenager, spent some time in a circus. And I thought he would fill that film up with memories of his own life in the circus. And it's a flat film. It doesn't do much.
It's watchable to me. And it's not bad. And I don't know that I know of a Henry King film that's out and out bad. Everything is pretty much okay. And he could go a little off. You know, he was known for his Americana, mostly. I mean, that's... Although there are also things like Captain from Castile.
Well, he loved Mexico. He spent a lot of time in Mexico. But yes, there among those Americana films, for example, I was floored by Over the Hill.
Oh, yes. Wonderful film.
Fantastic film, and no one knows it.
No. And even one that pretends to be Americana, and then it starts getting dark, and that's Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nelly,
mm-hmm.
Which just becomes kind of a... an Americana noir, in a way.
I miss him. I even stayed in touch with his widow, Ida, after Henry died, and she moved down to Tampa. And I'm not a collector of memorabilia, but the one piece of memorabilia I had that I really treasured, and it was stolen, was the Photoplay Gold Medal for Tolerable David.
Oh, that's sad.
As the best picture of 1921.
Hmm. How sad. You should find who stole that and prosecute them to the full extent of law.
I would be satisfied to get it back, but I think it's good and gone.
Yeah. One thing I was really always interested in about King is that he seemed to love to do his own location searches. He flew. He was a pilot, and he loved going out. And I sometimes wonder if he chose his projects just based on where he could shoot them.
Well, Zanuck trusted him enough that he would allow him to go on location, which was not permitted to a lot of Fox directors. And yes, he was a licensed pilot and was flying till he was 90 years old and was able to pass a pilot's physical until he was 90 years old.
That's amazing. Yeah, he was, even when, I think the latest I ever saw him was on Kevin's Hollywood series. And he looked great then, and he must have been in his 90s then, wasn't he?
He was born in 1886.
Wow.
And most of the interviews, I've worked on the Hollywood series, and most of those interviews were filmed in 1977, so he would have been 91.
Yeah. Yeah, and was really sharp and on top of it and everything. Now, you clearly must have run into Bill Wellman more than once, didn't you?
No, I never met him.
Really?
The closest I ever came to him, one of the things that I did for the Directors Guild was to untangle the rights to the men who made the movies, television series,
yeah,
that Richard Chickle made for WNET in 1973. And Wellman was the subject of one of those, as you know, but it was the only one that we couldn't free for distribution because a man named Lester Cowan, who owned the rights to the story of G.I. Joe, would not clear the clips. We even got Bob Aldrich, who was his assistant director on that film, to go to Cowan. He came back and said, "This man is set in concrete. Stop trying."
I remember when all that was going on, but what was Cowan's point of view on that?
Well, I asked
him. It could have been money because he just dug his heels in, right?
No, it wasn't money. It was the fact that he resented the excellence of the film being credited to Wellman when he thought it was entirely due to himself.
Wow. Well, there you go. But luckily, it has been cleared up. Maybe it was cleared up after his death, wasn't it? Or
Mrs. Cowan left it to USC, and they turned around and sold it right away.
Great.
To Larry Stern, who owns it now. And it's very easy to deal with Larry Stern because he's interested only in money. You know, it's like that apocryphal story when Eisenstein was in Hollywood and 1931, and Samuel Goldwyn approached him and asked him whether he could remake Potemkin, except with Ronald Coleman and a little bit cheaper. And Eisenstein's response, whether real or invented by some wag, was that it would be impossible because, "Mr. Goldwyn, you are interested only in art, whereas I am interested only in money."
I like to think he really said that. Well, after your Black Hawk days, how long were you at there, in fact?
I left Black Hawk in April of 1976 and then went to Europe to work with Cavalcanti on his autobiography, which did get done and has been published, but only in Portuguese.
That's why I don't have it.
And then... then I started, let's see, yes, I think it was after Black Hawk. And then I started at the Directors Guild in September of 1976. Was there until 87, gone briefly, and then came back for 2 years more.
And what was your capacity at the Directors Guild?
Well, the title of the job was Special Projects Officer, and what I really did was to manage the educational and cultural life of the Guild, pretty much everything except nothing at all to do with contracts or labor negotiations. It was a wonderful job. I really enjoyed doing it. The Guild was totally supportive. We had ample funds to work with. I was well paid, but after that number of years, I just got tired of it. And I had begun part-time teaching by accident. I was asked by Beverly Houston, who was then head of the Critical Studies Department at USC, and who had come from Pomona College, where I had taught a couple of film courses successfully a couple of years before, to come in there. As I thought of myself as the paramedic film professor, Arthur Knight, had had a heart attack.
Oh.
And was unable to work that semester. So they asked if I could come in on short notice and cover for Arthur, which I did do. And it went well. It was one semester. And then Arthur came back, and apparently the students said, "We don't like him. Get back that other guy." So they did. Then a similar thing happened at UCLA. A professor named Nick Brown was in a horrible automobile accident, and they needed somebody to step in and teach a class in place of Nick.
Was it a film history class?
Yes, it was. And it was a wonderful class. I still remember it, and I'm still in contact, in fact, with one of my favorite students from that class, Alexander Payne.
Mm.
Who, of course, has turned up to be a prominent director.
Yeah, not too bad.
Yeah, and we're still good friends, and we still get together and talk silent movies all the time.
Now, when you were given the opportunity to teach a class like that, what kind of thrust did you give the class? Did you try to do a general history and cover all the major trends?
Well, it was a survey class. I remember I have a friend, he's a very good filmmaker and designer, named Elliot Noyes, and he once said, "How is a film teacher like a dog?" And I said, "I don't know, Eli, how is a film teacher like a dog?" "Well, he has to go around and pee on all the movements." And that's sort of what I did, you know. So, you know, I had so and so many classes and so many years for the silent period, and I knew I had to do something with French film and German film and Russian film and Griffith and early film, and just sort of divided up the weeks and then tried to be as imaginative as I could in dealing with each of the things that would constitute a well-rounded survey.
And in those days, you were showing your class 16mm prints, or did you have 35?
I was. Well, at USC, we did have some 35. When I finally got into a room that they were willing to equip for variable speed 35. But before that, I was bringing in my own 16mm silent projectors because I had a bunch of them modified for variable speed and was scoring the film off of turntables.
Ah.
It seems prehistoric now, but it worked fine.
Sure.
Now, of course, they use DVDs. Nobody shows film anymore in classes, except for brand new pictures that are just about to come out. Mm-hmm. And the DVDs are fine because they run at the right speed and they have music and, you know, the whole thing is there in a little box. And no matter how poorly equipped the school is or unprepared the teacher is, they can present the film well.
Yeah. Did you generally find that your classes responded to the silent films that you showed?
The classes were a huge success. Started off with about, Arthur had about 20 people in his class, and that's where I started the first time. As it grew and grew, and by the time I left, I had 80 people in the class. In fact, that's one of the reasons I left, because in graduate school, you can't have a graduate assistant reading work for evaluation, and I was going home with two big boxes of term papers on a hand truck from these 80 graduate students, and I just didn't feel that I could do justice to the level of education they expected from what they paid to go to USC. But yes, the classes grew and grew. Now, let me give you a caveat. I don't think it was because I was so brilliant. It was because in those days...
So it was partly that.
I won't agree to that. That would be too self-serving.
That's why I said it.
But all the incoming students had to do two semesters in which they made silent films. In those days, it was Super 8 for the first one and 16 mil for the second one. And one of the things they discovered in my silent film class was that the people who had made these films in the teens and 20s, they were not so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of ideas to be gained for their own work from studying the work of these silent film masters. And I think that was the reason the class was such a hit.
I can see that. It's, because I think a lot of people, especially today, we seem to be living in a time that's more and more obsessed with itself and seems to start viewing the past as just being this irrelevant something. But every time I learn something new about the past, even a piece of machinery, an old, an outdated piece of machinery, there's always something ingenious about it. There's every step of the way, people have been ingenious all through history. They just keep thinking, and that's certainly the case with silent film, as we are experiencing this weekend, and as you and I experience every weekend, I guess. It's just incredibly sensitive work and powerful work, and these guys were really, really good at it.
They were. I used to start the class with some film that I thought would knock everybody silly and would make them start come with a predisposition to respect the work. So sometimes it was the Lubitsch Old Heidelberg, sometimes it was Ben-Hur, sometimes it was Stella Dallas. Nobody can resist films like those.
Sure. Well, we just saw Ben-Hur in 35 at one of the big movie palaces in L.A., and it's just astonishing. There's no way around. No matter what you think technology is now as opposed to then, it's astonishing. And it just, you can't believe what you're seeing half the time. It's really amazing. And you compare it to the 59 Ben-Hur, and that just looks like a piece of, a bunch of toys in front of a painted backdrop, and the 25 one is alive and huge.
Well, William Wyler is an awfully good director too. Well,
I have no complaints about Wyler as a director, but comparing those two films, the 25 wins out every time to me. But that's just me. when did you devote yourself once again strictly to film preservation and restoration?
In 1989. In 1986, Republic Pictures had bought Black Hawk Films. What they really wanted was the mailing list. They had, as you know, a big library of westerns and serials and cheap pictures that couldn't get shelf space in video stores. And they thought that the mail order business would be the way to get those films out. And the best way to get into the mail order business was to buy the top company in that business, which they did do. But they weren't interested in the films, and they weren't interested in the equipment. And I got a phone call from Ted Ewing, who was then the president of Black Hawk and who was negotiating that sale to Republic. When I tell this story, I explain that I now understand how teenagers get pregnant. It's so easy to say yes. he rang up one day and he said, you know, we have to be out of the building by, he gave a date of 2 months or something away. Do you want the equipment? And I said yes. So then I went home and we talked it over, and I realized this stuff was not going to go in any spare bedroom. And I bought an industrial building to hold all the equipment. I paid scrap metal value for it.
Wow.
And the cost of moving it out. But now I had, you know, this building and the cost of modifying the building. And I felt like I had to go into business to pay off the building.
Sure. This was in L.A.?
Yes. So I did. And I began to do restoration for studios. And then a few months later, I got a call from Republic. Are you interested in our film library? And I said, well, sure, I'm interested, but I don't have the kind of money that film library is worth. And they said, well, make an offer. You might be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked for an inventory, and they sent it, and I looked at it, and it only confirmed what I thought. I had nothing like the money the film library was worth. I didn't do anything. couple of months later, they called up and they said, "What's the matter? You don't want our film library?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love your film library, but I don't have the kind of money that it's worth. I live in fear of debt. If I can't pay for something on the spot, a car, whatever it is, I don't buy it." And I felt I couldn't buy the film library. They said, "We'll make an offer." So I made an offer. They said, "Well, that's an awfully low offer." And I said, "Well, that's the money that I have." They said, "Could you come up $25,000? And I said, "If you agree to sell it for that sum, I will come up $25,000. But if you're just using it as the beginning of a leverage negotiation, then let's not pursue it." They said, "No, you come up with $25,000 more, it's yours." So I did. And it was mine. And I had to get it out of some very expensive storage they had it in. Fortunately, it had already been moved from Davenport to Southern California. And my building had space. So I was able to get the whole film library in there. And I would say we had paid it off within a year.
Wow.
And then I began depositing the preprint with the Academy Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Film Archive. And I really think of that library as kind of a sacred trust, because Kent Easton spent his whole life building it up, and I was not going to squander it, you know, because I respected him enormously, and he did something nobody else had ever done. So we now have about 20,000 items on deposit at the Academy Film Archive.
Wow.
And as you know, beginning in 1989, I began to do video editions.
Mm-hmm.
A drop in the bucket compared to the resources that we have to draw on, but I guess there have been something over 300 that have come out in the last 24 years. And there's still a lot of films I want to share. So as long as I'm physically able to do it and can recover the cost of doing it, I'm going to keep doing it.
What are the films that have been most popular that you've released?
The one that has done the best is Nosferatu. Now, Kino has come along and done a rival version of Nosferatu, which cut into it considerably. But up to the time Kino came out with it, I think we'd sold 45,000 copies.
Wow,
of Nosferatu. Essentially, the films that occupy the most pages in basic film history books are the ones that do the best. And the films that I want people to see because they're great and nobody's ever heard of them, like, say, Grabiche, they do the worst.
Yeah.
I always hoped that I could build up enough of a brand in my own name that the fact that I had done a film for video would constitute an endorsement.
Yeah.
And people might take a chance on it, but that really has not proved to be the case.
So what's your plan for the future? How many are you planning to do per year from... Or do you ever know that?
I don't think that far ahead. It's, I mean, right now it's what I can. It starts off with what Flick or Ellie is willing to publish, or if they turn it down, what somebody else is willing to publish. And Jeff Messino is a very small shop, as I am, and he's not set up to do volume, and neither am I. So we choose the projects carefully, and try and do films that. For which we share enthusiasm, but it's limited to maybe four or five a year at the most.
What's the status of the Republic stuff now?
Paramount owns it. Mm-hmm. The Republic Pictures was bought by Aaron Spelling Productions, and Aaron Spelling Productions was bought by Paramount, and the Republic Film Library got swept into it, and they have done a good job. They've invested serious money in preserving Republic Pictures, and they've made a deal with a company called Olive Films, about which I know basically nothing, but Olive is putting out volumes of releases, I think a couple a week, of Republic and low-end Paramount films so that they are becoming available. I'd like to have secured the rights to some Paramount silent films, and I tried through Leonard Maltin, through Tom Cruise, through various people I knew that I thought were important to Paramount, but the best response I could get was that we're not an eleemosynary organization, and if I could offer them some serious money, they'd be glad to talk to me, and otherwise they weren't interested.
Wow.
And there's no serious money in silent movies.
That's really too bad, because it's a lot of that stuff really needs to be seen.
Well, look, Paramount did the most fantastic job resurrecting Wings.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful. It cost them $750,000, and they promoted it heavily, and it sold 11,000 copies.
Wow.
Now, I'd be thrilled to sell 11,000 copies of most of what we do, but they regarded it as a dismal
sure.
failure.
Well, with that much money invested in it, and they really did do it right. I mean, as far as I can tell.
Beautifully.
Yeah. So I was tickled to see it. All it lacked was magnoscope, which is hard to do on TV.
Yeah, but you can do that part at home if you have projection in a big screen.
I keep trying. Well, so now, I mean, you live, we won't be specific about where you live, but you live way outside of Los Angeles, and for that matter, way outside of San Francisco. You live way outside of every place, as far as I can tell.
I know. I always dreamed that I could, and I do.
Yeah. So how does that have an impact on what you do for a living?
Well, we just do it differently. I work with the same editor that I've worked with for the past 24 years. He knows pretty much what I would do. And I send them the films I'm working right now on a film called Timothy's Quest. I send him four single-spaced pages of notes on what I wanted. He will do it. He will send me a DVD-R back for checking, make any further changes I want. And, you know, of course, he's paid for his time, but I don't have to keep running to L.A. I don't have to rent an office down there. I can stay home and pet the dogs.
Yes.
And it works out perfectly well.
That sounds good to me.
We send our transfers, our telecine, to a place in Michigan. Again, with detailed notes. The guy is very scrupulous. He reads the notes. He follows the instructions. I get a screener back. He doesn't return the film until I've approved the screener or asked for changes, and I can do the whole thing staying at home.
Wow.
Work with about 10 different musicians, and when we first started, you know, I insisted on seeing the score and playing it through on the piano or hearing it. Well, now I've done so many films with Mont Alto and Robert Israel and Frederick Hodges and Eric Boeheim and, you know, the other people whose work I admire and trust, that I just send them off and I'll get a rough and approve it and get a finished result. And I just stay home and think.
Well, I think that sounds like a splendid way to live your life. So we'll cut it short. We need to get out of here for reasons we won't tell you about, but thank you very much, David. This means a lot to me that you've been on the show.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
Well, that was sure fun for me, and I hope it was fun for you, and I hope that I will talk with David again one of these days, because there's a lot left to talk about. He lives way up in the middle of nowhere. I don't even know how to get to his place. It's like way up there in California. And so I'll never go to his house. It's too far. Nobody's ever been there. It's too far away. But someday, when he next comes to Los Angeles, or maybe at the next Silent Film Festival, I'll grab him again and we'll continue this conversation. And I look forward to that day. I want to especially urge you, because I still am deeply in the red in this thing, to buy my DVD of The Lost Remake of Beau Geste, and I really think that you would enjoy it. It's a fun documentary, and also the DVD has the original parody of Beau Geste that the documentary is about. And because it was completely unseen by the public for some 70 years, It's a little bit of a rarity, and I think that you'll enjoy it too because it's a fun movie. You can also help me out by going to the website and clicking on the Amazon links to books and records, not only my own, but for everyone else who has ever been on the show. And that'll give me back pennies on the dollar. It's not much, but it all adds up, or at least theoretically it all adds up, but you have to have enough sales that way to add up. And I rarely have that many sales this way, so I urge you to do that. Just click on the Amazon links, or if you just want to make a contribution to help us keep going, there's a donate button too, and that'll take you right to PayPal. So there are many ways to help out, ways that'll cost you money, ways that won't, but all of them will bring you either a book or a video or just the great satisfaction of knowing that you help keep this ship afloat, and I appreciate it. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire, for being my announcer, my webmaster, James Hutchins, for designing thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Please visit them both. And also, of course, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for their wonderful, wonderful theme music. And I love listening to it each and every week. I've never grown tired of it. I still get a kick out of it every single time. So, thanks to all of those. We will be back next week with another fascinating guest. And until then, don't you worry. We're going to fix it in post.